We'll open up the hearing, and we have our presentation. Haley.
All right, good morning, Board Supervisors. Haley Lane, Film Director. I have a PowerPoint presentation for you all this morning, so I will just wait for that to pop up on the screen. Okay, great. So Kidder Creek Orchard Camp Project, next slide. This project includes three main aspects: a zone change, a use permit, and environmental impact report. The zone change is to rezone approximately 170 acres from timber production to rural residential. The use permit is to increase the allowable occupancy at the camp from 165 guests to a total occupancy of 622. Increase the physical size of the camp from 333 to 580 acres, and addition of structures and recreational features, including a pond and ancillary facilities. It is anticipated that the expansion would occur over a 20-year period. Related to the EIR, this would revoke all of the previous use permits to consolidate all of the approved uses into a single use permit and a certified environmental impact report. The 622 occupancy number was based on a recommendation from the Planning Commission, which I will get into in the later slides. Next slide. Project location. The project site is located west of the community of Greenview at 2700 South Kidder Creek Road. So as you can see on that slide, the red boundary encompasses all of the parcels associated with the Kidder Creek project site. Next slide. Zoning. So there has been a lot of discussion related to the adequate or the appropriate zoning for this project. So as mentioned, that red boundary encompasses the entire project site. As you can see, most of the parcels associated with this project are rural residential, with the exception of the TPZ parcel, which is proposed to be rezoned to rural residential. As you can see outside of the boundary, most of the adjacent parcels are rural residential and also TPZ. And so when looking at our zoning code, Article 15, our general uses allowable by a use permit, one of those identified uses include recreation facility private. And so that is defined in our code as a recreation facility operated by a nonprofit organization and open only to bona fide members and guests of such nonprofit organization. There is also a definition in our zoning code called recreation facility commercial, which is defined as a recreation facility operated as a business and open to the public for a fee. So what are the differences between the two, right? So the way staff is interpreting this is recreation facility private. You pay a fee and you apply to go to the camp. Not everyone is accepted into the camp. Folks can be denied to the camp. So it's different than a pay-to-play situation, such as, think, the Mount Shasta Ski Park, right, where you go to the facility, you pay to use the recreational services, and then you leave. And so that is the main difference that staff understands, you know, between the two. And so we are confirming that the zoning is most appropriate with recreation facility private. Next slide. What is land use compatibility? So there's been a lot of discussion on what is compatible and what is not compatible related to this project. And so a general definition of land use compatibility is a compatible use is a property use or service which is capable of direct association with certain uses or other uses because it's complementary, congruous, or otherwise not detrimental. So meaning that, you know, the uses are in harmony with each other, adjacent and surrounding of the project site. What is an incompatible land use? So that means a use or a service that is incapable of direct association with certain other uses because it's contradictory, incongruous, or discordant. This can also create spot zoning. So that previous slide where I showed you all of the zoning designations, it's currently TPZ, right? So staff is of the belief that if you were to change the zone to anything other than rural residential, considering that the whole project site outside of that TPZ zone is already rural residential, it could create spot zoning, which I will explain in the next slide. So what is spot zoning? This refers to applying a map classification for purposes of the zoning ordinance to a particular parcel of land without regard to its surrounding designations. While zoning regulates the land use in whole districts, spot zoning makes unjustified exceptions for a parcel or parcels within a district, and there have been some court cases that have actually deemed this illegal. So staff is of the understanding that if we were to, you know, in a hypothetical situation, propose this to be zoned commercial or industrial, that would, you know, be an example of spot zoning. Next slide. So in the next few slides, I'm going to discuss the Scott Valley Area Plan. So that black boundary is the project site, the KCOC project site. So most of the project is under the non-resource area policies, which, as you can see, is that green, blue color, you know, the center and the north portion of the project site. The red to both, you know, the corners of the project site, that is the excessive slope. And that small, you know, yellow-green is the prime ag soils, which is their irrigated pasture with mature trees. And so most of the development is within the non-resource area of the policies, and all of the newer proposed development is within the non-resource area of the policies. Next slide. So as mentioned, this project site is predominantly within the non-resource area of the Scott Valley Area Plan. And I wanted to note Policy 31, which was actually identified by staff years ago in the ISMND of the CEQA document. And Policy 37 reads that the policies of this plan shall not apply to developments functioning and legally existing prior to the adoption of this plan. There's no language within the Scott Valley Area Plan that speaks to, you know, should a use expand or change. It just says as long as the use has been legally existing, then, you know, the plan shall not apply. But taking that even just out of the conversation, staff is of the belief that many of the non-resource area policies are consistent and, you know, complementary of the Scott Valley Area Plan. So as earlier discussed, we are defining this use as recreational. So as you can see on the screen, Policy 31 notes that only agricultural, residential, open space, and small-scale commercial, industrial, recreational uses and public or quasi-public uses may be permitted. Similarly, Policy 32 notes residential, small-scale, commercial, industrial, recreational uses and public or quasi-public uses may only be permitted when they are clearly compatible with the surrounding and planned uses of the land. And as previously mentioned, staff is of the belief that, yes, this you know, project and zoning and use is compatible. In the staff report package, there's also a number of other policies that I mentioned, but I just wanted to highlight, you know, the general policies related to the non-resource area policies of the Scott Valley Area Plan. Next slide. So there has been a lot of comment related to this is, you know, a dense development, it's intense, this should be, you know, considered small scale. And staff finds that small scale and intensity aren't really necessarily clearly defined within the plan or even our zoning code. But there is one mention of density related to the non-resource area policy section, which notes that there's one dwelling unit per 27 acres for non-resource. So taking the whole project site, that would be a maximum of 21 dwelling units. The project description identifies 11 dwelling units, which is under the 21 maximum. Most of the campers are going to be staying overnight in structures that are not defined legally as dwelling units, more so, you know, cabin structures which don't have sanitation facilities, cooking facilities, and things like that that are associated with defining something as a dwelling unit by the building code. Next slide. So this is another metric that staff has used to for a point of comparison related to density. And so this is our wastewater disposal density standards that we evaluated. So in its current form with the 10 parcels, you know, if there was no change at all, 10 parcels would equate to 20 acre feet per year. Based on the Scott Valley Area Plan development standards, those parcels currently could be subdivided into 22 parcels, which would equate to 44 acre feet per year. At the 844 build out, which is the previous occupancy number, that would equate to 25.3 acre feet per year. At the 622 build out, which is the current recommendation by the Planning Commission and staff, that would equate to 18.7 acre feet per year. So as you can see, this development density is in line with, you know, the current density standards. Next slide. California Environmental Quality Act. So I will take a moment in these next few slides to discuss CEQA and everything that is included with it on a high level. So CEQA is intended to inform government decision makers and the public about potential environmental impacts of proposed activities and to prevent significant avoidable environmental damage. There are five main objectives that CEQA seeks to accomplish. One, disclosing environmental impacts. Two, preventing or reducing environmental damage. Three, disclosing agency decisions. Four, promote interagency coordination. And five, encourage public participation. The process of CEQA is intended to be objective, and the process uses factual, scientific, reputable data. Next slide. Consideration of environmental effects. What CEQA does. CEQA discloses information about the effects of a project could have on the environment. It identifies mitigation measures. It describes feasible alternatives to the proposed project, and it solicits agency and public input throughout the process. What CEQA doesn't do. CEQA doesn't require mitigation for existing environmental conditions. It doesn't advocate for the project under evaluation. It doesn't require project denial due to significant environmental impacts, and it doesn't address economic and social issues such as property values. Next slide. Environmental setting as baseline. So you may all have noticed within the CEQA document that the number 310 is used as the baseline. So that number that was used includes campers, staff, and volunteers. So the true existing condition numbers of who all is on the site at any given time on any given day. This is different from the 165 number from the use permit because the 165 number in the use permit is just in association with campers. So it did not take into account volunteers and staff and other folks that would be on site at any given time. And so what is baseline, also known as environmental setting? Environmental setting is existing physical environmental conditions at the time of the notice of preparation or when environmental analysis begins, which also applies to initial studies. Environmental setting is normally the baseline for determining significance of impacts. There is some flexibility in determining what is baseline, such as average conditions or the maximum actual activity level. A hypothetical future level of activity is not the baseline. An example of that would be, you know, if the maximum permitted level is never ever reached with a certain project. Future physical conditions can also be a suitable baseline, but it must be supported by substantial evidence. Next slide. So what is substantial evidence? And this is taken straight from the CEQA guidelines, and I just wanted to take a moment to explain the definition of substantial evidence. So substantial evidence, as used in the guidelines, means enough relevant information and reasonable inferences from this information that a fair argument can be made to support a conclusion, even though other conclusions may never be reached. Whether a fair argument can be made that the project may have a significant effect on the environment is to be determined by examining the whole record before the lead agency. Argument, speculation, unsubstantiated opinion or narrative, evidence which is clearly erroneous or inaccurate, or evidence of social or economic impacts which do not contribute to or are not caused by physical impacts on the environment does not constitute as substantial evidence. Substantial evidence shall include facts, reasonable assumptions predicated upon facts, and expert opinions supported by facts. Next slide. So to highlight what is substantial evidence, it is facts, reasonable assumption predicated on facts, and expert opinions supported by facts. What it is not argument, speculation, unsubstantiated opinion or narrative, clearly inaccurate or erroneous information, or socioeconomic impact not linked to physical environmental impact. Next slide. So I've discussed what CEQA is, but I wanted to also touch on what CEQA isn't. The intent of CEQA is not to be perfect. Perfection is not required or even sought after. It costs too much and takes way too long. CEQA is not an advocate for a project. It merely just discloses environmental impacts. CEQA is not the project itself. It is also not a chance to fix existing problems. It is not supposed to be a history of everything, such as an encyclopedia of everything everywhere related to the project. The intent of CEQA is not to analyze the worst case, and it is not to be the sole decision maker. Next slide. Cater Creek Environmental Impact Report. So this project has been many, many years in the making, so there have been a lot of opportunity for public comment in relation to the CEQA document. So back in 2016, an initial study mitigated negative declaration was prepared. And then in September 2019, that was elevated to a draft environmental impact report. Based on the breadth of comments that were associated with that draft EIR, a first partial recirculated EIR was posted April 2022. Then in June 2022, a second partial recirculated EIR was posted related to the noise analysis. And then in August 2022, a draft EIR was posted. And then in November 2022, a final EIR was published and posted. So there have been many, many opportunities for the public and agencies to submit their comments and concerns related to this project. Next slide. Planning Commission meetings. So this project has been heard multiple times within the Planning Commission. So back in August 2022, there was a presentation of draft documents prior to the completion of the draft EIR. In November 2022, the Planning Commission recommended approval to be elevated to the Board of Supervisors. In January 2023, it was then heard again based on a reevaluation of concerns that were identified by the board related to wildfire, zoning consistency, water issues, and biological resources. And then in February 2023, there was a recommendation of modified mitigation measures through this process. So mitigation measures 8.1 and 9.1 hazards and 4.7 were modified. And the added and modified mitigation measures are contained in the most recent MMRP. Next slide. Mitigation measures. So mitigation includes avoiding the impact altogether, minimizing the impact by limiting its degree or magnitude, rectifying the impact by repairing, rehabilitating, or restoring the impacted environmental resource. It also may reduce or eliminate the impact over time through actions that preserve or maintain the resource. And it also may compensate for the impact by replacing or providing substitute resources or environmental conditions, including through permanent protection of such resources in the form of conservation easements. Next slide. So there are a number of mitigation measures that have been incorporated into this project and then also are reflected in the mitigation monitoring and reporting program. So similarly, what I've done in the past with projects that have CEQA documents, I'll highlight the questions associated with each environmental area and the mitigation measures and then what they are reduced to after the implementation or incorporation of those mitigation measures. Next slide. So air quality. Does the project expose sensitive receptors to substantial pollutant concentrations? This was noted as potentially significant and reduced to less than significant with the incorporation of mitigation measure 3.1. Next slide. Biological resources. Does the project have a substantial adverse effect either directly or through habitat modifications or any species identified as candidate, sensitive, or special status species in local or regional plans, policies, or regulations, or by the California Department of Fish and Game or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service? Or does the project interfere substantially with the movement of any native resident or migratory fish or wildlife species, or with established native resident or migratory wildlife corridors, or impede the use of native wildlife nursery sites? So noted as potentially significant, but with the incorporation of mitigation measures 4.1, 4.2, 4.3, 4.4, 4.8, and 4.9, reduced to less than significant impact. Does the project have a substantial adverse effect on any riparian habitat or other sensitive natural community identified in local or regional plans, policies, or regulations, or by the California Department of Fish and Game or U.S. Fish and Wildlife? Or does the project have a substantial adverse effect on federally protected wetlands as defined by Section 404 of the Clean Water Act through direct removal, filling, hydrological interruption, or other means? Noted as potentially significant but reduced to less than significant with the incorporation of mitigation measures 4.5, 4.6, and 4.7. Next slide. Cultural resources. So does the project cause a substantial adverse change in the significance of a historic resource as identified in section 15064.5? Does the project cause a substantial adverse change in the significance of an archaeological resource pursuant to section 15064.5? Does the project directly or indirectly destroy a unique paleontological resource or site unique geological features? Does the project disturb any human remains, including those interred outside of formal cemeteries? And lastly, would the project cause a substantial adverse change in the significance of a tribal resource identified in Public Resource Code? So all of those noted as potentially significant, and with the incorporation of mitigation measures 5.1, 5.2, and 5.3, reduced to less than significant. Next slide. Geology and soils. So does the project result in substantial soil erosion or the loss of topsoil? Noted as potentially significant and reduced to less than significant with the incorporation of mitigation measure 6.1. Hazards and hazardous materials. Would the project expose people or structures to significant risk of loss, injury, or death involving wildland fires, including where wildlands area adjacent to urbanized areas where residences are intermixed with wildlands? This was noted as potentially significant and with the incorporation of mitigation measures 8.1, 8.2, and 8.3 noted as less than significant. Would the project expose people or structures to a significant risk of loss, injury, or death involving flooding, including flooding as a result of failure of a levee or dam? Noted as potentially significant and reduced to less than significant with the incorporation of mitigation measure 9.1 hazards. Next slide. Hydrology and water quality. Does the project expose people or structures to a significant risk of loss, injury, or death involving flooding, including flooding as a result of a failure of a levee or dam? Noted as potentially significant and reduced to less than significant with the incorporation of mitigation measure 9.1. Noise. So does the exposure of persons to a generation of noise levels in excess of standards established in the local plan or a noise ordinance or of an applicable standards or other agencies? This was noted as potentially significant and reduced to less than significant with mitigation measures 12.1 and 12.2. So for these next two, would the project generate a substantial permanent increase in ambient noise levels due to noise produced by traffic increases, and the project, when considered with future development, is likely to have significant cumulative impact due to traffic and noise sources? These were both noted as significant and unavoidable at the 844 capacity, and this is in relation due to noise generated from traffic on peak days related to the camp. And so when there is an impact that is noted as significant and unavoidable, there's a few options a lead agency can take. One is you can prepare a statement of overriding considerations, which essentially creates, explains findings saying, hey, we recognize that there is this significant and unavoidable impact, but based on these findings and these reasonings, we're still going to certify the project. That's one pathway. The other is to, reduce the impact so that it decreases that environmental impact from, significant and unavoidable to something that can be mitigated. And so this was the main reason why the Planning Commission opted to reduce the occupancy from 844 to 622, because it lowers that impact to potentially significant, or it lowers that impact to less than significant. And the reasoning for that is, with the traffic noise, I believe that, so the industry standard is 65 decibels. Our county noise element, our maximum for things is 60. So there's a 5-point decibel difference. And so it was within that 60 to 65 of the generation of noise, but since it was over our noise element, that's why it was considered significant and unavoidable. So with that decrease, it kind of takes that issue out. Next slide. Fire behavior analysis. So there's been a lot of discussion at the Planning Commission level and also, through comment letters related to wildfire risk. And so OES Director Brian Cianone has prepared a presentation to go over those specifics of fire modeling, because he can, you know, discuss it way better than I can. And Andy Workin of Cater Creek, he has a presentation related to their wildland emergency plan, which speaks to, you know, their evacuation and things like that. So I just wanted to preface that while I finish up my next few slides, that they have two presentations prepared related specific to the wildfire issue. Next slide. So to finish this up, there's been a lot of public comment throughout the years, as you can imagine, related to this project. And so, you know, I believe we are over 350 comments at this point in total since the project, began or was submitted. And so I just wanted to highlight a few public comments, support, mentions throughout the comment letters. This includes community benefits, local employment opportunities. This could be a place for youth. It's family oriented. There are volunteer opportunities. It is a place to serve the community and ministry opportunities. Next slide. Public comment opposition. So these are just a general summary of just, you know, the main comments that have come into the planning department. Concerns regarding the definition of the project is inconsistent. Traffic and transportation issues, which can also include ingress and egress issues, wildfire risk, noise impacts, capacity increase. It is inconsistent with the Scott Valley Area Plan, and there is an incorrect use of water rights. I wanted to note on capacity increase, staff recognizes that the use permit doesn't really clearly define the capacity as a condition of approval. So just wanted to make the board aware of that should they potentially modify the use permit and add in a condition related to, you know, a max level of occupancy, whatever, you know, turns out to be that occupancy level. That concludes my presentation, and I also just wanted to note really quickly there are two typos in the resolution, and page 3 of the resolution, number 2, it should read at the end of it, first partially recirculated EIR and second partially recirculated, it says DIR, it should be EIR. And then number 3, adopts pursuant to, says SQA, it should be CEQA, S-E-Q-A. So I just wanted to make that a note for the record for the public.
And a fresh, clean copy of that.
Yep,
will
absolutely.
Be made available for the
and
signature.
One other question for council was the date right now in the resolution is May 2nd. Should that always be the second reading ordinance date? So that was a question from the board. Because right now it's May 2nd, so that would be the hypothetical second reading. So.
But this is this a resolution or ordinance?
Could be ordinance or.
Well, it'd be the resolution states the date
right
for the second reading, I believe.
And it should be the second reading date.
Okay, so whatever the second reading date is.
So that may need to be modified as well.
Sure, yeah, and I can modify that.
Okay, we have just a minute, please, if you would. Kaylee, we have a potential questions.
Sure.
So we go to the board, Supervisor Howe.
Sure.
I just had, could you clarify the occupancy statement you made? Is that beyond what the recommended reduction is that you were referring to?
The 844 number?
Yeah.
So the 844 was the first primary occupancy number, which is evaluated in the EIR
right.
document.
Right.
And so the recommendation currently is the 622 number from the Planning Commission and also from staff.
I understand that, but were you saying we have the opportunity to modify beyond that?
Absolutely.
No,
mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to clarify.
Sure, yeah.
Clarify what you said.
Yes, no, thank you, sorry.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
To clarify that even further, is that 622 with staff? Or
correct.
That?
It's with staff and volunteers. It's everybody that is going to be on site.
Including drop-off, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Correct.
You want to press anything?
Sure. Follow up on the drop-off, including the parents dropping them off.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
One more quick
absolutely.
Question.
Sure.
You said that this project is over 20 years time frame. Is the occupancy level over 20 years as well? Is it staggered? Or
yes,
is it
staggered.
Can you break that down?
Yeah, so let's see. It was in the previous EIR. If you give me a moment, I can
sure.
pull that up.
Okay.
And then I can get back to you.